make sure I'm on the right side and that I haven't turned the tape over too many times.
Right, I know.
How did the... I want to come back to some earlier things, but let's continue along this line. How did the research people feel when there was major changes occurring in the company? Let's say the Conoco deal, for example. When it looked like there was going to be some real dramatic differences in the company's outlook.
Yeah, I think not. I don't think there was much concern when it happened as to much later, because at the time, in the early 80s, was when we bought Conoco, and that was the same time, of course, and because of Conoco, that the Bronfmans ended up owning a quarter of the company. That probably worried many of us in management more than it did the research community as a whole. But as time, and the reason was is because Jefferson had just gotten in the saddle, and everybody knew that research was going to be king for some years, and there was not a lot of worry. We were going through expanding the station. In that period, Central Research doubled in size. One of my jobs was to build a molecular biology component here, which ultimately went off and marked the DuPont work. And this was a truly outstanding group, but this was also the atmosphere in those days was very positive research, and no one worried very much about these crazy business things that were happening on the side. As when economic times got harder, then people suddenly started to wonder what influence of the Bronfmans having, or what influences, or was this a good idea of becoming an oil company? Conoco is a good example, and it's trite to say that oil doesn't mix with everything, and it really doesn't. Their whole idea of life is based on very simply drilling holes in the ground, and it's like a bingo game or a dice throw that you either strike it or you don't. And their exploratory money, their research money, goes in, by and large, is the big research money goes into drilling holes. It's not back doing some research in a lab. They don't spend that much in that. So they can't understand why we would work on a product that might take 6 years to develop. That's inconceivable to the oil company people. And we tend to look at them as dirty fingernail guys that we admire because of their ability to make money, but they're not that exciting to be around intellectually. So my own opinion was I thought we should have kept DuPont and the Conoco at run them well, but to ensure the connection up at the top. But instead of that, these latter chairmen like Woolard and Heckert contributed this too, unfortunately. Their idea was to bring these two things together and to bring management from one side over to the other. Every time we've done this, it's been a disaster. I mean, these guys don't understand. Hey, how can you take a guy that's an oil man and ask him to make decisions on high-tech products? I mean, this doesn't work. So, I'd say that your question was, how did the research people think about this? I think because times were so rich for research, no one thought about it then. It's only been 6 or 8 years later that they started to worry about it.
You know, there were a number of still good chemistry papers coming out. I'm still back in the 60s. It looks like cyanonitrine, which I think is the first one on that.
Yeah, that's the nitrogen analog of CO2, CN2. And I did not discover it. Frank Marsh did. But my contributions to that were largely theoretical. The people working on it weren't very strong from the physical side, and so my contributions was more on the physical, mechanistic, and theoretical sort of stuff. But the chemistry and the conceiving of doing it and what have you all belonged to Frank Marsh. So I was a legitimate helper, but not the driving force there.
This is at the same time the papers of Blanchard started coming out with amino bicycloalkanes. There was one on dicyanoethylene, full papers many years after the
amino. That's with Karen. Right, that's the one I was saying, Wieskin.
Okay.
This was interesting. This had to do with the mechanism of 2 plus 2 cycloaddition. Wasn't called that.
Then spiroconjugation papers, first one. Aromatic azapentylenes, new heteroaromatic systems.
Yeah, my contributions there were more theoretical. Rudy Carboni,
right. My
old friend Rudy, was the one who conceived of those, and these are these multi rings where everything is nitrogen inside holding them together. And that for a while, some of those, the tetranitro derivative of the dibenz tetraazapentylene was a high temperature explosive. You could use it in oil wells because you didn't get pre-detonation. You could get it down in the damn thing where it got hot as hell and just wouldn't melt or decompose, and you could set it off when you wanted to. Again, for reasons that I can't remember now, I never made any great money for the company, but it was an interesting looking. A lot of explosive materials came out of there. Los Alamos was interested in a lot of these and moved around with them. May have abused them for all I know. No, they never told me. I was later on their advisory council out there, on the weapons division. But if they... if they ever did, they didn't. Nobody told me about it. I probably would have known it.
And in 1967, also, you, there's a chapter in Kama's book, theoretical aspects of cyclobutadiene.
That's my son. Hello?
Yeah. I was struck by a sentence here that quoting, the failure of chemical intuition, I guess that was what I was keying in on, with respect to an apparently simple molecule brought the chemist face to face with a new kind of chemical behavior. That's the opening paragraph of that chapter on the cyclobutadiene problem. And I was struck by that.
This is with Tolle Anastasio.
Yes.
Tolle went off to be a professor at Syracuse. By the way, we have a large number of folks here that go a lot, work with me and others. We have a large number of guys that spent 2, 3, 5 years here and went off to the university, some to fame, some to at least a happy career anyway. Yeah, I remember that now that you mentioned it, and I can't dredge up it precisely what prompted that. I wrote that, and I'd have to think about it. It obviously wasn't that deep, was it?
Well, you went on to say that cyclobutadiene proved the testing ground for theory as well as the experiment, that it proved to be rich in both areas.
Yeah. This was one of That goes, actually, cyclobutadiene was one of Robert's earliest loves. He was very interested in that, and of course I've got Andy and me and others interested in it too. That chapter is probably a fair amount out of date because a lot happened not too much later than that with regard to generating cyclobutadienes various times.
'68, you spent the year at Harvard.
Right.
Which we, I think, talked about. This is when you collaborated with Woodward.
Yeah, and I taught Bartlett's course in advanced physical organic for him, or my version of it. And I saw a lot of Woodward. We had dinner one night a week together, just the two of us, and he had reestablished the Woodward seminars, which were very popular, and so I went to those. And Bartlett and Swain seminars were still in operation. So that was a fairly exciting time. That also was the period where King and Kennedy were killed. And that was an exciting time to be at Harvard. Harvard Square was lit up after that.
I happened to be living in Boston when in 63,
mm-hmm.
JFK.
Right.
So it was, again, I understand that.
I had been down to the shore when Martin Luther King was killed. I didn't get back until really late. Like, I can't remember where I was or who I was with. It was probably not worth repeating, but I got home at maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and at 6 the phone rang, and it was Woodward to tell me that Kennedy was shot. I said, what? And he said, well, we talked about, Bob and I talked about politics a lot, and I never forget that. He woke me up. I could barely think straight. I hadn't been to bed by 2 hours.
What were his political inclinations?
I think he was fairly conservative. I think he was fair. I don't think he was biased in the sense of holding bizarre social views or things like that, but I think he was certainly a political conservative. He really didn't go for the 60s, the things that were going on in the 60s, the students and whatever. Then again, neither did I. I was a lot younger than he was, 20 years younger than he was. I thought it was not my cup of tea.
But well, that year, yes, that sixth year that you were there, that would have all still been in the midst of that.
Oh, yeah.
Cambridge was certainly...
as I say, during that, first King was killed and Kennedy was killed.
That's really like a sabbatical. Did the company have that policy?
Paul called and asked me would I come up and be a visiting professor there for a year, that they would take care of, they would pay so much, what have you. And so I went to, we had a program here that would allow you, with management's concurrence. That was just so that somebody that was at the bottom of the staff didn't wangle a deal to go to Podunk U somewhere with somebody of his to where we might not have wanted to be bothered with it. But the vast bulk of the people that were asked to teach or to be a visiting professor were usually, I think practically all of them were seated to. The company was very generous. They just they made up the difference. They made up Harvard paid me, and then the company paid the difference to bring this up to my normal income here.
No, that's very
and good. Paid all the expenses.
Wow.
paid the room, board.
Did you take your family with you?
No, I came home usually every couple of weekends or something like that.
Were you at this time doing any experimental work with your hands, or were you mostly doing paper chemistry?
As an associate director, or science director as we call them now, and as director of research, I kept a group. And I was probably the only one in history here that actually kept a research group with a group leader overseeing this, who reported just to me. So I did that up until 79, when I became department head or vice president. And I was doing nothing with my hands. I have to confess, I dropped out somewhere in the 60s of doing anything on my own. I had a little lab, and I used to continue to putter around, but after that, I spent a fair amount of time in research, but it was all theoretical things. I mean, I did a lot of computing. It was not uncommon. For a long time, I was hiring a half-time mathematical assistant programmer from an engineering department, and these guys or girls would get excited with what we're doing. And those days, for our purposes, we couldn't run when we wanted to. We might have to run it after midnight, but we might want to be there to see it. So it was not uncommon for me and whoever it was to go down to Levere's down in Newark. We're at the big computer center, and be there at 1 o'clock in the morning to run batches of stuff through. So I did a lot by hands, but it was with a pencil, paper, or computer, but it was not in the laboratory.
I was really struck by how you moved into that area.
Mathematics has been the driving force. I've always had like many people who don't have any real talent there, a love for it and a desire. This is why the collaboration with Dick Merrifield was so good, because I provided a lot of intuition, he provided a lot of rigor, and we had just a great time being here, working together on this.
What's his background?
He's an MIT spectroscopist.
Okay.
And don't think all these we went through a I didn't go out and seek Dick was a supervisor here himself at one time, and he was the father of exciton theory and organic crystals. Okay. In that Merrifield. But Dick had gone back to the bench, and then the last 6, 8, 10 years here, he chose just to work with me, and we both did theory together, which is a nice life for him. he had the boss's protection. And I keep telling him, I said, Richard, you're never going to get me. I said, I can't, you'll get normal raises and that sort of thing, but you can't get the kind of treatment that you really ought to be getting if you were doing something, you know, outside. Absolutely not. He said he's enjoying life too much to worry about whether he was making an extra buck here or there.
Somewhere in here. Well, the work with Park on the macrobicyclic means late 60s also.
That's a case where we literally do have important work unpublished that are. Chung Ho and I, once a year or twice a year, look at each other and say, God, we've got to do this. Nothing much ever happened.
So I think there's at least 3 or 4 papers in that.
Yeah.
1970, you became Associate Director of Research, as it was called then.
That's our science directors today.
you had said earlier that none of these promotions came, I mean, they came as a surprise to you.
Yeah, I literally, in as much as I hadn't been thinking about them or contemplating them or wishing for them or what have you, and it was always a bittersweet feeling, because it's impossible not to have a good feeling about it, but I always had a sinking feeling, I mean literally a sinking feeling, to say I'm getting this much further away from science and that's not where I really want to be. As a matter of fact, I turned down during the 70s, middle 70s, when, after the oil crisis, and during Shapiro's reign here at the company, research wasn't one of the top things, and all the company was looking into shoring up existing processes and not spending much money on new products. And Irene DuPont used to come out and see, when I was up here running this job as director of research, for now it's called vice president of R&D, Irene DuPont used to come here. I'd gotten to know Irene for one thing or the other, and he would come out and he'd be waiting for me at 8 o'clock in the morning, and the gist of this was to say, hang in there, things are going to get better, don't worry about the way things are going. And when Cairns got ready to retire in the late 70, 79 or so, Dick Heckert, who was then on the executive committee and a past graduate from here, and this was just before, this was just at the time Jefferson was going up. He came out to see me, and he said that the executive committee wanted me to replace Cairns when Cairns left, for me to jump over the assistant department head. At that time, we had an assistant department head. His name was Monroe Sadler, who used to be the director or the head or vice president of the old development department, which was a business entrepreneurial group. And he told me, right frankly, to my face, he said, Monroe's not going to get the job, but we want you to do it. And he said, he said some of the people on the committee think it'd be a good idea if you went out for 2 or 3 years to an industrial department. And I said, well, I'll think about it. He looked a little funny, but he said, well, let's talk about it a week from now. So I went downtown to see him a week after that. And I told him, I said, Dick, I've thought it over. I said, I really like being director of research here. It's a really super job. It's still close to the science and whatever. And I said, thank you, but no thanks, I'll stay. And he looked at me, and then he burst out laughing. He said, this is the first time, and to his knowledge in DuPont, that anyone had turned down a vice presidency in the department. And I said, well, Dick, and I said, I love you guys, but it's got to be a first time for everyone. So I'll take it back. This occurred about a year before Ted retired, one or a year and a half, something like that. And then when Ted retired, Jefferson called me downtown and told me that I was vice president of the department. So I never went out to an industrial department. So then I reported directly to Jefferson for those years.
You did a little bit of crown polyether chemistry.
Yeah, that was interesting. I didn't even know Charlie Peterson.
Okay, that's how I was going to ask if that came out.
Oh, yeah, Charlie. I didn't even know Charlie Peterson, but I was in talking to Jack about this work Chung Ho and I were doing. He asked me, he said, do you know Charlie Peterson? And I said, who's he? And he said, he's at Elastomers. And he said, he's making these really incredible ethers, and he's gonna republish on them soon. And I said no. So I went up to see him. I went up to meet Charlie, and I was really impressed with this. And this there's a side tale to this. I said after we had exchanged some chemistry and what have you, I said, well, One of the things that we really ought to do is incorporate ether linkages into our macrobicyclic amines, because these look like they'd be incredible agents for. He said, I'll never forget when Charlie, he said, I'd be honored if you want to do it. And, he said, I'm just going to work on the monocycles. And he said, I got plenty to do with that. He said, if you want to put ethers in your bicycles, great. And so Chung Ho did that. And just after he was finishing, just as he was finishing this, and we were in contact while I was on a trip to Europe, that just as he was finishing, and I went to Strasbourg for the first time, and there was a young faculty member there, Jean-Marie Lane, who I didn't know or didn't know of or anything, and I went and gave a lecture. My last slide was this cryptate. And he came up to me after the lecture and he said, Dr. Simmons, I didn't know whether I should meet you or not. He said, but I think I ought to show you this. And he had the galley proofs from tetrahedron for this this synthesis. And he said, well, he had read my stuff and he had read Charlie's stuff and our communications, we both communicated the stuff. And he said, he read these and he decided to put them together. And I that's fine, you know, one of those things in life that happens. And we also went on to become great friends over the years and have visited each other and what have you. And when he won the Nobel Prize, as others were running on test, he called me called me from France twice to make sure I wasn't upset by this. Within days, he called me. And, when I got the Chandler Medal a couple of years ago from Columbia, Breslow was recounting some of the things that led to Jean-Marie's work and to ours, and he very graciously told everybody I got screwed. I should have shared this thing because we had made this thing too. Mm-hmm. We made the barium complex. But so that's how you get close to fame, but not quite. And I did a few things with crown ethers, like wanting to look at reagents like potassium permanganate oxidations. Mm-hmm. How would they go? Another Oriental, Don Sam, a Chinese who went on to do great things in DuPont, who's done very well in DuPont.